Welcome to the Shay Anything Podcast, everybody. Doug Williams alongside Nelson Figueroa this week. Andy Martino, too good for the show, was always too good for the show, but this week it actually got in the way of him appearing on it. Nelson, thanks for stepping in.
My pleasure. It seems to be my role for my career.
We actually have a lot to talk about today. Some of it is new compared to when yesterday I got together with Max and I texted you this morning what we were planning on discussing on the show. And then today, the Mets apparently, actually it's official, have re-signed or technically signed Devin Mesoraco to be what you'd think is their third string catcher for now. Could be their backup. Want to get to that in a second. And then the JT Realmuto trade is apparently very close. He will be becoming a Philadelphia Philly. With Mesoraco, if you're a pitcher on the Mets staff, and apparently he got rave reviews because mm-hmm. he's just a good game caller, good guy to work with, isn't that what you want in a backup catcher? Like, nothing against Travis d'Arnaud. He's got other skill sets, but isn't that more the prototypical backup catcher?
Yeah, I think we see that in the past, Travis d'Arnaud was exposed as far as his game calling, as far as holding the running game, catching and throwing, which is still going to be an issue coming back from the Tommy John. You don't know if he's going to have a setback or not. So I think that insurance of getting Mesoraco, that was huge. My biggest problem with Mesoraco isn't necessarily how he handles the staff.
Right.
It's just he gets hit with more bats than I've ever seen.
It's a tough job.
Every single game, it's two or three guys taking a chunk out of him, whether it's in the back of the helmet or it's on the shoulder or whatever. He takes a beating, so there's going to have to be something done with him and where he's comfortable setting up in the catcher's box. But without a doubt, handling that staff, the way he prepared, I mean, they were bringing guys like Nito up just to watch right. this guy work and how he did it. It was at a different level than we've used to be seeing.
What this means is basically unofficially Travis d'Arnaud, it would seem, is tradable. You know, maybe you want to keep him because when Wilson Ramos is on the bench or maybe he gets hurt, you want a catcher who can provide some offense for you, and that's pretty much exactly what Travis d'Arnaud can do. With JT Realmuto, Nelson, if he gets traded to the Philadelphia Phillies and they look at his salary, realize he is not getting paid that much money and they still have the flexibility to sign a Bryce Harper or Manny Machado, how daunting is that possibility if you're the New York Mets or, frankly, any other team in this division?
Extremely daunting, and I think that was the case going into the offseason, is that you knew the Phillies had money to spend, and they were looking to do and make a big splash. They haven't done that big splash, but they've made some solid moves thus far. It's still always been a question of their pitching staff, but a catcher is a very important part. Alfaro is a great catch-and-throw guy right. defensively. They loved him. He had to take a back seat to Wilson Ramos because it was the sexier option at the time, and now you think Alfaro would have been that guy to step forward, but he's batting .220. So they're looking for a little bit more offense, and they're going to get a lot more offense out of Realmuto. My biggest concern now is not just Realmuto, but they still have that money to go get yeah. one of the two big superstars, and then that really puts them right in the top of the conversation.
This Phillies team could potentially be dangerous, and if you're a Philly fan, I mean, even though you're giving away young talent, this move could be dangerous, and if you have the money to spend.
Yeah, I'm well past giving away young talent. They could have all yeah. the young talent, but that's the difference. When the Mets were in that Realmuto sweepstakes, they were talking about Syndergaard and Rosario or right. Conforto and Nimmo. Those are major league caliber players now and guys that could be all-stars that you were trying to get for Realmuto. It's a different story when somehow now they're just taking prospects on the hopes of what they might pan out to be. That, to me, is shocking,
yeah.
to say the least, when you have teams like the Los Angeles Dodgers who have bona fide stars that they could move and maybe not that one superstar they keep asking for, but there's enough pieces around that they could make a much better offer. So I'm really shocked that they're just going to take three prospects.
I want to know what this time of year is like. Pitchers and catchers are reporting. Lots of position players are already down there. When you're a pitcher, so let's say you're Jacob deGrom, Noah Syndergaard, Steven Matz, Zach Wheeler, and you go out there. Is the first pitch you throw like the most sore feeling you ever feel? Like, is it a really difficult process to get through get to the point where you feel like a normal human being?
If you're fighting for a job, yes.
Yeah.
But when you're on the team and it's just kind of before even week one, what you're trying to do is pace car. You're trying to pace yourself so that the most important thing is how you feel the start before your last start, because the last start is really just a tune-up. It's, you're going to face probably minor league teams. You're not going to face a team you might face in the next week when the season opens. So that's really just a tune-up. But early on, what you want to do is you don't want to do too much. And I think a lot of young players, when they're excited and they haven't done it before, they tend to overdo it. And that's the guys that wind up hurting themselves early on because they're not used to it. These guys have been together long enough, and I think they've learned from a pace car like Bartolo Colon that, hey, tranquilo, take your time.
It means calm for any non-Spanish speakers out there.
He's amazing. He does it all, this guy. So what you want to do is be able to build up, because you've been building up your arm strength and all that stuff, so it's not a shock to your system. You've been throwing bullpens. Maybe you only throw one or two before you go down there. So you go a little bit early, and you feel like you're someone that can go down there. And now you're working on your craft. You're working on moving the ball around. You're working on your rapport with those catchers that you're going to work with, because that's a huge thing, is that now with Wilson Ramos, they got to get comfortable with him in only about 6 weeks.
Let's talk Noah Syndergaard specifically, Nelson, because he is a guy that I know that you've talked about all these starting pitchers for a lot of hours throughout your life, but Noah Syndergaard to me is the most fascinating, because his obsession with analytics a lot of times fascinated you. How hard he was on himself at the end of last season fascinated you, and the numbers look like something so different from how he seems to feel about his game, how he's talked about sometimes in the media as being this oft-injured, semi-effective guy. When you look at his career numbers, they're great. The one fair criticism you could say is, you know, when's he going to put together a full season? Do you think this is the year that he does that and shows you that he is that guy for 30 or more starts?
I would hope so. The ability is undeniable. When he's out there on the mound, he's one of the best in the game, and that's no lie. So I sat there for countless hours, and all the pundits here in New York, we get on him and say, oh, you know, he hasn't really done anything yet. Even his own pitching coach said that. I mean, that was a quote from Ireland. He hasn't done anything yet, which is quite frankly true, because he hasn't put together 30 starts. You like what you see in flashes, and in, if you could have it the whole season, I mean, sky's the limit still. And that's the scary part.
Right.
I think when you see what he's capable of, there's not many guys that can come to the major leagues throwing three pitches. And when you talk about 100-mile-an-hour fastball, they try to survive on that. He was never that guy. From the moment he got to the big leagues, he started tinkering with his mechanics. He tinkered with grips. He tinkered with pitches and how to throw them. And he just soaked up everything like a sponge. By his second year, he had 5 pitches in the tank with a two-seamer at 98 to 100 miles an hour that moved, you know, almost 2 feet at times, it seemed. And his ability to dominate with being in the strike zone almost too much has been incredible. I mean, not a lot of pitchers can do that and survive. What I have seen from him is the growth of he expects more from himself. And I love that. The only problem is when he says his mechanics are flawed, there's no way. He has the simplest mechanics you could have for a guy who's throwing 100 miles an hour. He's not overthrowing. He's not trying to do everything with his body at wrong times. His ability to keep everything in sync and in the proper order, and with the last thing is his fingertips on the baseball and how he releases it, and he's able to make that ball move from 98 to 100 miles an hour the way he does, it's incredible. So for me, I do believe this is going to be the year for him. I do believe that he's finally put aside all the bulk lifting and the I'm the strongest man in the gym kind of thing. And I think because he's looked around and now he's not the top dog. And that's a tough pill to swallow a lot of times when you're used to being that top dog. DeGrom is doing it with pure stuff. You can see Wheeler has taken that next step and has showed how to pitch when he doesn't have his best stuff. But I do think that Syndergaard still has the complete package.
So what happens to that strike throwing thing that you mentioned, which I find so fascinating? He almost throws too many of them. Mm-hmm. And that's something that you and I have talked about in the past, where you don't want to be walking guys, but you also don't want to be throwing, I don't know, what's the number of strikes per at bat you actually want to throw? 3 or 4? Like, so how does he change that? How does he become, in your mind, an elite pitcher while also adding that to his elite stuff?
Well, the problem is what kind of balls are you throwing? Or if you're throwing balls that as soon as you let them go out of your hand, it's non-competitive.
Right.
They read it, they see it. But at 98 miles an hour, you kind of have to be a little jumpy there at the plate. My biggest thing for him is believing in that inside fastball and making it a four-seamer, a true four-seamer that if they're going to hit it, they're going to probably hit it with the label. They're not going to hit it on the barrel. it's the amount of foul balls that he gets because he tries to pitch so fine to the corners, and especially where it's out over the plate. He seems to like to throw to an area, I always say it's like four balls wide by three or four balls high, so 16-ball area out of a 70-ball strike zone. He needs to use the whole strike zone. There are guys that can do it, like Jacob deGrom and Wheeler at some times, but I played with Roy Halladay, and he could not pitch to the top part of the strike zone. He was still a damn good pitcher at right. the bottom part. But in this day and age where hitters are doing the launch angle swing and they're trying to beat you to the low part of the strike zone, that's where you get all the foul balls and you wind up battling yourself rather than just going out there with one pitch and getting one out. You don't want to throw too many strikes. Like, the idea is to make the pitches that are strikes be balls, and that's where you get the weak contact. When you're throwing too many strikes that are predictable, the movement of them and where they're going to end up, that's where you start losing the battle.
Yeah, it's just never been a problem with his stuff, obviously. You know, it's just a matter of whether he, last year he seemed oddly hittable. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you picture yourself as a fan or whatever you are while you're watching thinking, gosh, this must be really hard to square up, really hard to stay in the box on this guy. And somehow they were doing it. And the same thing happened across town with Luis Severino. And it was like, there's got to be something happening. There's got to be some sort of flaw. And with Syndergaard, I think I believe you. It's a small quadrant of the zone or when you're in the box where you know the balls mm-hmm. are going to go. So I don't know. I think he is one of the more interesting Mets to watch because he, in my opinion, takes them to a next level, especially if Jacob deGrom is anywhere close to where he was last year. But let's talk about the bottom of the rotation. Mm-hmm. This is something that we've talked about a lot over the past week, 10 days. Gio Gonzalez is still out there. Wade Miley got signed for next to nothing. You have Vargas in there. You got Hector Santiago as your sixth starter or a 4A guy. Do you believe they have enough at the bottom of their rotation?
I believe they do. I just, it's amazing that we're sitting here trying to pick apart the fifth starter on a staff, you know?
Yeah.
We're still worried about the fourth starter a little bit because we hope that Mats takes that step as well. But I do think that Vargas, second half Vargas, which is a Vargas who didn't miss a turn in the rotation, because even when he came back from, you know, the broken hand, he was getting skipped over as the fifth starter a lot of times. So I think now that he had that regular turns in the rotation, plus the fact that I think it takes a lot to deal with where you're pitching and you're humming along at 73 pitches through five innings and you're still getting taken out of ball games. Rich Hill is dealing with that with the Dodgers, it seems like, all the time as well. And it doesn't matter what you're making. It doesn't matter what you're getting paid.
Yeah.
It bruises the ego that you don't think I'm good enough to go three times through the lineup. And I think that it took him a while to say, you know what, if this is the way it's going to be, so be it. I'm going to be the best I can and not pace myself anymore to try and get to that third time through the lineup, but really attack the first times through
the lineup. Well, isn't it, I worry a little bit about the bullpen with a guy like Vargas. Mm-hmm. Because even if second half Vargas shows up and he's solid, if your manager doesn't believe you can get guys out in the third through the order, you're really relying on the rest of your starting rotation to go deep when they're out there, because that's, I mean, what, four innings? That's a four-inning start. That becomes a bullpen game. And when you have guys like Lugo and Gesellman as key cogs in your bullpen who Mickey's going to rely on for two innings each at times, you don't want to get to the end of May and have them be gassed kind of mm-hmm. like they were last year. Yeah. So don't you want a fifth starter? Where I agree with you that I don't think it is worth all this frustration and tweets that, you know, we need a starting pitcher because Jason Vargas is still in the rotation. It's not like a five starter is the most important, but in some ways, Nelson, he's just as important as any other starter in the mm-hmm. rotation for that reason.
I think that's why, as a veteran and what he was capable to do and why they brought him in there, hoping that he could be that same all-star caliber pitcher who was pitching in the American League with the same stuff. It wasn't like he was going to all of a sudden find a 98-mile-an-hour fastball or find a new way to throw his slider. He is who he is, and he's comfortable with that, but it was a matter of finding that steady rhythm, that ability to repeat his delivery and all those different things. I do believe that even if he's able to give you five every time out, you have guys that can be those middle, the bridges to get to the back end. And it also depends with what the score is. I'm not saying that you don't care when it comes to Vargas, but once you go through Vargas's start and you have a Jacob deGrom going the next day, right, you're not really worried about how taxed right. the bullpen is, because you're really probably just going to need the eighth and ninth inning guys.
I'd just be interested to see. I don't want what happened with Vargas to happen again this year, for the reason that it's not that Vargas wasn't good, it's just that he may not have had the chance to be good, got such a slow start. And you saw with all the pitchers that didn't sign till late yeah. last year, they didn't have good starts. Most of them didn't even have good seasons. Andrew right. Kashner and Vargas among them. So sign one now if you want them to be a big part of your team. Don't wait until you're going to stunt their season and potentially hurt yourself down the road and spend money while doing so.
Yeah, that was strange about that whole thing, because those guys that signed, even Jake Arrieta, who signed late, yeah. I mean, he started out doing well, and everybody's like, oh, this is a key cog. And then all of a sudden, by June, July, he seemed to be gassed. He wasn't the same pitcher down the stretch that they were hoping for. So I think it shouldn't really play, because guys are working out and these guys are veteran guys. They've been doing it for years. That's why they're free agents. They've right. done it long enough. But for some reason, you know, you get to new surroundings and you have to kind of prove your worth, whatever they're paying you. And you go out there and the pressure is different. I don't know what it is about it, but it definitely, if you look at everyone's numbers who signed late, and all, we still have over 100 free agents out there, including some of the biggest stars in the game.
Yeah, crazy.
It didn't pan out for any of those free agents last year.
Do you think, because we talked to a lot of baseball players and a lot of Mets in spring training, and most of them seem, no matter what, every year it's full of optimism. Is that something that players say in interviews, or is this time of the year actually the time of the year where you're like, you know what, like, I feel like we can make this work?
I think all 30 teams think that, honestly. Yeah. And if you don't, then you shouldn't be putting on a uniform. You have to believe that there's some way that it could happen. So it's a bad mindset to go into spring training.
Like, going, oh boy, this is
we
tough.
Got no shot. Let's see if we can't lose 100 games. So I think there's optimism in every single clubhouse. I think there are teams that know that they are, you know, the truth, and that barring injuries, they should be in play. There's, you know, probably the upper, say, 12 teams in baseball, and it's not always about the spending. I mean, there's some surprise. The Oakland A's last year with 97 wins, you know, Tampa Bay with 90 wins. If they just figured out how to do what they did a little sooner, they could have been an even bigger factor. So going into this year, I think there's always optimism in spring training. That's the beauty of it, is that you want to see what this team looks like once it's all put together. And anybody who sits there and says their team isn't the team to beat, it's foolish, because I don't think there's any – I don't know if there's been any pundits or any newspapers or magazines that have gotten it right yet.
Yeah.
These are the two teams that are going to be in the World Series, and you can bank on it. It just doesn't happen. That's the beauty of baseball.
Well, we're actually going to interview Todd Frazier a little bit later today for Mets Hot Stove, and I was thinking to myself, we have questions in there about the feel of spring training. You kind of know how he's going to answer them. Mm-hmm. They're still worth asking, but I do think that if players are honest with themselves, having an offseason like Brody had increases the optimism. It increases the excitement, because you look around, you see the new faces. Like, when you're getting ready to watch spring training this year, you're going to see a lot of new faces that are actually competing for big league jobs. Yeah. Like, you know, I said this on the podcast last week, so it doesn't necessarily bear repeating, but Keon Broxton and J.D. Davis are playing. You're not just looking at guaranteed AAA guys. Like, if they make it work mm-hmm. in spring training, they could be members of the team.
Yeah, so. We spoke with Brody. We had our meeting with him last week, and one of the things he said is, I'm taking the best 25. It doesn't right. matter to me how much they're making. It doesn't matter to me how much big league time they have. So a guy like Peter Alonso, if he goes out there and does what he did all season long and in the fall league and just hits the cover off the baseball, Brody wants him in the uniform. He's not worried about what's going to happen 6 years down the line with his salary. He's worried about where he's going to be in the Brody reign right now. You know, Brody has a 3-year deal. He wants to make sure he has the best team out there. That's why he made the moves that he yeah. made. He came in there. You can't have a 5-year plan on a 3-year contract. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah, it's a good way to put it.
You just can't. So what you want to do as that GM who's come in is, he has changed things from the bottom up. And that's what's been so fascinating, is that we're so used to everybody trying to do it from the top down. Make the big splash. Go get the big name. This is the guy that's a game changer. And as a Met, we've seen that guy's usually in the DL come June, and you have Eric Campbell batting in cleanup, and yeah. you're worried about what's going to happen. So I think what he's done is he has taken that team from the bottom up and made the floor a lot higher than the ceiling used to be. You know, always worried about the top of the ceiling. The floor has now been raised. Yeah. And now you got guys like Jed Lowry, where you're saying, well, where's he going to play? We've got Cano. We've got McNeil. We're comfortable. Now you look at Todd Frazier, and it'll be interesting to ask Todd Frazier about moving over the first base
yeah.
if need be. That's something that he's probably never had to deal with before.
Well, I love the point you make about Brody's contract, because he's human. So if you start a new job, you want to make a difference, right? I do think there are some GMs in that position who take the job and start the rebuild, because it almost gives you a longer shelf life. Because let's say you get the GM job of a team and you say, let's start over from scratch. Mm-hmm. You're not going to fire that guy after 2 years if the team's not winning a World Series, right? Because you're still waiting for that rebuild to fully show itself. Whereas Brody, what I loved about what he did this offseason was say, like, we're going to be one of those few teams nowadays in Major League Baseball who stunk and wants to be good in back-to-back years. And what that does, though, for him, to your point, is increases pressure in the 3-year contract where, like, he's gotta perform.
This is New York. This is New York. Yeah. Remember, right now in San Diego, you had, and I love Andy Green. I mean, he's a former teammate of mine. And, you know, he, in his first 3 years as a manager, didn't have a lot of success, but he didn't have a lot of things to work with.
Right.
So they went and got younger. They made all the trades. After they put that all-star team together that didn't work out in a matter of 3 months, they decided, all right, let's blow it up and get all the prospects. And now so those prospects are finally coming to fruition. He got an extension, having one of the worst records in baseball as a manager. And the GM is perfectly comfortable because it's part of the process, the whole trust the process thing. You can do that in San Diego.
Yeah.
It's lovely to go to a ballpark and take in a ball game in San Diego, whether they win or lose. But in New York, in this market, I think that's why someone like Brody, who has the experience of dealing with this market and saying how the Mets need to be relevant and in a big way. And so he's been able to steal the back pages all offseason long and continues to do so.
Well, I want to preface the fact that we actually have to wrap this podcast up by saying that the only reason we are wrapping Nelson's episode so quickly is because Todd Frazier is basically waiting on the line right now, I'm hearing in my ear, from Port St. Lucie. So we're going to go talk to him. If we did not get to more questions, well, we didn't get to questions on Twitter. We just didn't have time. But we really, by the way, I'm just seeing JT Realmuto was traded to the Phillies. So we started the podcast not knowing that was officially going to happen. Sounds like it's going to happen now. Nelson, even though we couldn't go longer with you, we appreciate you taking the time coming in early in your Chin Music t-shirt. You got to be nice and casual while I'm in the...
Hey, I'll take a casual day any day.
Thanks for doing it, man. We appreciate you.
Thank you as well, Doug.